Welcome back to the Personal Branding Podcast. I'm your host, Anna Vitone, and today we have a very special guest on our show. Isra Nasser, a therapist, mental health expert, and author, joins me to discuss her upcoming book on toxic productivity. In this episode, she shares how the publishing industry works, the process of getting your book published and out into the world, and what it's actually like working with a publishing house. Isra also shares her system and process for content creation, which has enabled her to grow a platform of over 200,000 followers on both Instagram and TikTok. I'm also so proud to share that Isra was a former student of the sponsor of this podcast, Personal Brand Accelerator, a three-month course designed to help you build your personal brand and create content with confidence. If you are ready to share your story and post authentic content on social media, you could be a great fit for PBA. We invite you to join the waitlist for our program and submit an application when we open for enrollment on December 2nd, 2023. More information can be found in the show notes. Without further ado, let's get started. You've been working on the manuscript.
Yeah. So I've been working on the manuscript and it all came to be in such a like an unplanned way. So I wasn't even mentally prepared for it the way it happened. But I finished all the contracting with the publishers in February. And it wasn't until like mid-April where I was like really starting to get into like the zone of writing. But what I didn't do is I didn't pause the rest of the things that I was already doing. So I took on this project of writing this manuscript, which at that time was meant to be between 50 to 60K words, but it's actually 80K words right now. So like I definitely overwrote and I didn't really adjust the rest of my life to make the space for it. I just kind of added it on. So this last year has been like very amazing. It's been so fun because I've been able to do all of these things. But I realize now in retrospect that I should have shifted some things around to make space for it. I continued working like a part-time therapist, continued working full-time in tech as a consultant, like ClinOps consultant for this like various consulting roles and, you know, continue being a full-time content creation.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk about that.
Yeah. And I also do these workshops, webinars, seminars, like those things. So I definitely do one big one once a month, right? So that was all still happening. And of course, like I have a partner. I live in New York City. And so I do a lot of things. And somehow, you know, post-pandemic, the travel just picked up. So I think I've like, so I was traveling too amidst all of these things. I think I've been on like 6 or 7 trips, which I'm so grateful for. So it's just like, I'm realizing now that I'm out of the storm as to what a whirlwind this last like 14 months have been. So now things are kind of settling down. I just finished the first edit of the whole manuscript a couple of weeks ago, and I sent it to them. So they're going to look at it and then they're going to send it back. And I think we might do one more round of edits. I don't know. Or it might be sections, but this first edit was like beginning to end, like literally from first word to last word. And it was pretty extensive. And I think the thing I also didn't anticipate when I took the book on was like the emotional component of what it would actually mean. I was very much like, this is going to be so fun, which it was, but I didn't anticipate like the emotions that it would bring up for me. The kind of like protectiveness you have about the words you've written. I'm sure you feel that. Or just like what it would just bring up for me. I wasn't anticipating it, which is very classic like me. So I wasn't surprised. Like I'm very much, when things come my way, I'm always like, oh my gosh, this is going to be so great. Let's just do it. And then along the way, I start to realize all the other things that come with it.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. I want to rewind here for a second. So You went through PBA in 2020, I think it was fall. Mm-hmm. And at that time, You were just developing WellGuide and creating the Instagram for it. And then literally flash forward maybe a year or so, you're like blowing up on Instagram.
You now have like over 150,000 followers, I think, between TikTok and Instagram combined. I think you're like over that. Yeah. And okay, I want to know like what happened in between the last time I saw you, really, which was like at the end of PBA, to now, where you have a book deal and your Instagram is just so helpful to so many people.
Thank you. Gosh, yeah. When I joined PBA September of 2020, Well Guide was about like 6 months old. I had started in April of that year. And I think what happened since PBA finished, or the last time we were seeing each other regularly, and now is I went through like various iterations and trial and error of finding my style of working. I think that was the biggest thing that was missing for me in the first 6 months, is I did not have an understanding of how I wanted to work, right? I knew what I wanted to do. So I had the what, I knew the why, right? Like why I was driven to do this, but I just didn't understand the how of creating my own system. So understanding the technology tools is just one part of it, right? Like knowing the Canva, designing all of that stuff, understanding the content is one part of it. But how do you stitch that into making like a workflow for yourself, like a work stream for yourself, so that you can automate certain things, how to use analytics to inform what you're doing, how to create a system for organizing your content. So I just essentially ended up doing a bunch of trial and error to find my work stream. So that's, I think once I got the work stream, it just created the system for me. And that was really helpful because now I could kind of plug it into the rest of my work, right? The rest of my life. So if I know that I'm doing like consulting work on Monday, on Tuesday, I have my content work. I have a system for what I'm going to do if I want to create content. I'm not just sitting at the computer being like, oh, like, what should I be working on right now? So I think like creating a system was really helpful. And I learned something from this woman called Komal Minhas, who is a resilience educator. And she does a lot of, I guess she does a lot of like leadership and business consulting for women in leadership. And she's also a friend of mine. So she said something that struck me, which was you have to take the time out first to create your system. It's really hard to create your system while you're doing the work. And in the startup world, we're very accustomed to doing that, right? Like, and that's kind of the world I've been in for the last 6 years. It's like you build the parachute as you're flying, right? But, and that's great if you are a team of people, but if you are a team of one, I really had to take some time away from content creation, probably in 2021 spring, and took like a couple of weeks off, which is so hard. Because, you know, the algorithm punishes you no matter how long you've been on it, no matter what your follower count is. You have so much FOMO because your other peers are continuing to deliver content, right? But I had to do that. And I just spent some time only focusing on creating a system for me, understanding how I can use other tools. Like I created an Airtable for myself. I took the time to create like a whole system of keeping myself organized. I was no longer just using Google Docs and my notes app, right? Like I really created, I got onto Later, which is this analytics platform. I set that whole thing up for myself. I created templates on Instagram so that I wasn't creating new content every single time. So I just like spent a couple of weeks creating that and just using that as a planning. And now I do that every like maybe like 5 to 6 months where I take out an afternoon and or a morning, or sometimes even a whole day. And I just go through all of my systems again. And maybe if I'm not using a subscription anymore, I cancel it. Like just reviewing all of the apps I've downloaded, make sure that if I'm not using it, I'm not paying for it and that kind of stuff.
So give us a visualization of what your system looks like.
Yeah, my goodness. So I think the first is I used to create content backwards. Like I would try to like find the graphic because I saw it or it was inspired. And then I try to backfill the content into it. And I stopped doing that. So I think for me, the way it works now is I do have a running list of topics on my notes app. I review that once every week or 2 weeks. And use those topics and slot it into Airtable, which is like a calendar view. So I create the content calendar. And then I kind of go into writing the content, right, for that specific topic. And then I break it into the Canva graphics. And I realize sometimes that the content that I've kind of created for one post can actually be extended into three posts, right? So then I break it down into three different Canva posts, and then I adjust the calendar accordingly, just move the tiles around. And then I just kind of link everything in there, and I have it for TikTok too. On TikTok, I usually do a lot of article summaries. So if I see an article, I'll just literally create an Airtable card for it with a title, topic. And then every couple of months, I'll review all of my pending title like cards to see if I miss something. But yeah, and then I kind of do that. And then what I've changed, which has helped me a lot, is I used to bulk like record my content. I don't do that anymore because I found that it wasn't a good use of my time. So I kind of film content on the go. This is something that you mentioned in PBA as well. Like, you know, you just make it a part of your life. So if I, you know, am getting dressed to go somewhere, I'll get dressed maybe 30 minutes earlier than my time, film like a TikTok or an Instagram reel. Or if I'm waiting for somebody and I'm a little dressed up, like I'll just kind of do it at that time. And with the Instagram graphics, I try to kind of just parse it out throughout the week, like two sessions, like 90 minutes, and just kind of go through that.
Yeah.
And that's what that looks like.
So I was going to ask, do you do a little bit every day, you'd say, for content?
I think I do a little every 2 to 3 days.
Okay.
Yeah. I will say that. I think like doing it every day was burning me out. I was doing that at some point.
Yeah.
And it's really it just felt like something that I was doing. I didn't feel very inspired when I did that. So if I planned at least 3 to 4 days in advance, that kind of gave me a little break from the doing so I could engage with other things.
Mm.
Yeah. So I would say 3 to 4 days in advance is my usual.
I love that you found that system. It's really nice to have a bird's eye view of everything that you're going to share that week and to have enough time to like go through things and really edit and refine them before you hit post, especially on an account like WellGuide, where you're sharing like really highly valuable pieces of information for people. And you know, it is really text focused too. So all of the text, every piece of copy really makes the difference. And I'm curious if you remember when your first viral video was or what your first viral video was.
Yes, I do. Because it's such a funny story. I was dressed up to go to dinner. So I was really dressed up. I think I even have false lashes on and I was doing like that winged eyeliner. And I tend not to be super, super dressed up in my videos because it's a mental health account. And it just doesn't feel like something I could maintain, right? Because I'm not overly dressed up all the time. But my husband was running late. So I was like, you know, I have time, I'll film this. And it was how to create relationship rituals for yourself, like in your romantic relationship. So I think it's like 5 ways to create relationship rituals. And that was last winter. So probably early of last year. Yeah, that was my first one. And I remember distinctly because I wasn't going to post it because I was really dressed up. Yes. And then it totally blew up. And I remember telling my friend, I was like, honestly, like, you just like never know.
You never know.
Like I was not going to post this. I was going to refilm it and maybe it would have happened in a different way. But yeah, so that was my first one.
And would you say now that you have an idea whether or not something's going to hit or not? Or do you think it's always a surprise?
It's always a surprise, which is like so mind-boggling, right? Because you're trying to create a system. But truly, videos that do really, really well, I don't really know. I couldn't tell you that there's like a through line, right? Like it's especially with the videos, with the static content, the ones about romantic relationships tend to do better than the others because people, I guess, are really seeking that information. But with the videos, there's no, even the time and the day when you post it, the audio, like you could do all of it. And I've genuinely sometimes been really surprised. And what's interesting too, is sometimes it really does so well on TikTok, but does not on Instagram.
Same.
Like there's no character.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, some videos I'll share on TikTok and they'll blow up, and I'll share the same exact content on Instagram. It barely gets any views. And actually now what I've started doing is kind of A/B testing my content. So I'll post one version on Instagram with a specific style of music, and maybe a few of the clips will be different. And then I'll wait like 12 to 24 hours and kind of see how it does, and rewatch it and see what I would change, how I would edit it. And then I'll post the updated version on TikTok and just kind of play around with different styles, more for myself, just to kind of improve my own editing skills. But I found that to be really fun, actually.
That's interesting. I might try that too, but I do notice that the crossover is really low, because the stuff that does well on TikTok, it's just for a different audience, I feel, you know, like they want to consume videos differently than the way people do it on Instagram.
How would you describe that difference? Like, what's your experience been of Instagram versus TikTok?
Yeah, I think like TikTok, there's a little more like unfilteredness. Like, I feel like the videos that do the best on TikTok are the ones that you're just like, la, 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 la. You just kind of talk about it, you talk into it, right? There's a lot of shaking happening. You're in the middle of doing something. Those videos don't do that well on Instagram. Instagram still, I think the clients on Instagram still want the little more polished, you know, perspective. Up until recently, I think it's changing because Instagram is trying to be competitive. But I think Instagram is a little more polished and TikTok is a little more like present. Mm. Like it's just they're happening right now in terms of like content where you are giving information.
Right.
I think the aesthetic videos, I don't make them enough to know what the trends are for that. But information consumption, people really want something a little more polished on Instagram.
Yeah.
That's what I've noticed.
Yeah. And okay, so people are finding you on Instagram, and are they going to your website? How have you seen that like filter into your other platforms, like maybe your email list or your site or any subscription that you have?
Yeah. So I think I see a lot of people signing up for my newsletter, and I think that comes from my Instagram, from the link in bio. And I get a lot of like emails through my like website that people have come through my Instagram. So what I see is like they click the page that signs me up for my newsletter. Once you do that, it takes you to the homepage, and then people send me emails, and it's usually either around like therapy services or stuff like that. And then with TikTok, it's interesting because it takes them to my Instagram, I think, or maybe my link in bio. I probably should know this better. But with TikTok, I have received like emails where people will say, I found you on TikTok.
Mm.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about getting emails? Do you respond to every single one of them?
If it's seeking services, yes. Even if I'm not taking clients right now, absolutely. Sometimes I get these like rando brand partnerships that I don't really understand, or you can tell it's like some kind of mass email list that I've been put on. I often won't respond to that, or I'll just tell them to take me off the list. But if someone has emailed me with a question around like us, like advice about something, like I will send an email back saying that I can't do that. So I do actually respond to all my emails.
That's great. Yeah. Okay. And so you've been now building WellGuide for the last few years. At what point did you know that you wanted to write a book, and how did that process unfold?
Yeah, so I always knew that I wanted to write a book since I was a child, but I always thought I was going to write a fiction book because I actually write short fiction. And I was taking a couple of courses here in the city, like pre-pandemic, a few short stories that will not see the light of day right now because I need so much refinement. But because I'm a big reader, I always thought I was going to write a fiction book. I never considered writing a self-help book. Even when I got on Instagram in 2020 and I saw all these other therapists doing it, one of my friends, Sahej Kohli, who was from Brown Girl Therapy, is writing this, you know, book as well. So I knew all of that was happening, but I never thought of myself in that way, that I was going to write this self-help book and people would read it, right? But I noticed in December of 2021 that a publishing company signed up for my newsletter, and then they sent me a DM.
Oh my God.
And Yeah. And then they sent me a DM in December and I was traveling and they just said, hey, like, we enjoy your content and this is who we are. If you ever think about writing a book, like, please pitch us. Like, we want to, like, we would, they were seeking pitches. And, you know, so I was like, hey, I'm like traveling. I was in Costa Rica at that time. I was like, let me come back and then we'll chat. And that was January of 2022. And so I met with them and we talked through what they were, what of my content they really liked. And they took out like 2-3 pieces that they really liked and they felt like would be a good book. And then they were like, okay, like, if you think you could write a book on this topic, toxic productivity, here's what our proposal looks like submit a proposal. So I planned the whole thing. It was like 16 pages. I took about 2 or 3 weeks to do it because I had a lot of content on toxic productivity that's actually not on Instagram because I do a lot of corporate workshops.
Yeah.
And I've done this like toxic productivity workshop maybe 8 or 9 times.
Okay.
So I have a lot of research on it. I had the deck on it and all that stuff. So I crafted this table of contents, chapter summaries. Like, I just like worked so hard for 2 weeks, did the proposal, submitted it. The next week they came back and they're like, amazing. This looks great. Let's move forward. And so that's how it happened.
Wow. And so is it like, what type of structure is this? Are they giving you a book advance? Is it some sort of hybrid model? Can you share with us a little bit of what that looks like?
Sure. I didn't know anything about publishing. So if anyone is into that and they're listening to this right now, I think the first thing I would recommend is take out 90 minutes, do an extreme Google search and understanding the publishing world, because that helps you when you contract negotiate, right? Because if you don't know, you just don't know. So it is a blend. So it's I got an advance and then it is like that royalty structure. And the way I think they've structured it is once you cover the advance in your royalties, then you start getting your royalties. So you can choose to forego the advance if you just don't want to do that. That's a choice people have. And if to negotiate, you should know what the industry standard for your type of book is, for the length it will be, what the royalty will be, like all of that stuff. It's out there.
Yeah.
So you should definitely look all this stuff up if someone is listening about publishing. The second thing I'll say is I know it's a little bit of an investment because lawyers are expensive. When you start contracting, and I don't even know if this is the question anymore, but I just want to share this.
No, I love this. This is great.
When you start contracting, just upfront invest in a publishing lawyer.
Okay.
Just ask for 2 hours of their time. They're going to, in the first hour, they're going to redline your first contract and they'll tell you what you should ask for, what should be taken out, what this means. Then you're going to go to your publishers. You're going to review all of that stuff. They're going to give you another contract with the amendments. The second hour, you're going to again review it with the lawyer, see if everything is great, and then you can move on because it will be so helpful for you because a business is a business, right? Like that's really what it is. And if you don't know, then you don't know.
Yep.
Right. Like you have to be your own advocate. And I learned a lot of interesting things. Like there's clauses in certain contracts where if you die in the middle of writing your book, your publishers can potentially own that manuscript. So you can push to have that clause changed. You can choose and I know it's so morbid, right? But do you really want something being published under your name when you didn't really finish writing it?
Wow.
Right. There's clauses around movie rights. You know, one of the biggest like self-help turned movie example is What to Expect When You're Expecting.
Yeah.
And that woman was very smart. She had a lot of foresight. She got that before when she was just writing a book. There's international rights. There is publishing in other country. There is translation, right? There's so many things that you just don't know. Like I didn't know any of it. So I did that. I got the lawyer. He was really great. And my publishers are so great. My gosh, like they were just on board with everything. Yeah. So that's something I would say for sure.
And
do that.
Do they provide your editors and will they help you market your book?
So I think it depends on different publishing houses. I'll speak to my experience and yes to both. So they acquired like their talent acquisition, acquired the book deal with me. They have an editor like a team that I've been working with. And I love that because their editors are all clinicians who have journalism or writing or editorial backgrounds, which is great for psychology self-help, right? They do have a marketing arm as well, like a press arm. But I do think that even though press is really expensive, try to find your own press as well. Because the publishers will do they will do it to the degree that they are invested in it, right? And they have other books as well. And they have a calendar and, you know, all of that stuff. And I know people, I know other authors from them who didn't do, they didn't do their own PR. But I think, like, you know, no one's going to be as invested in your work as you are invested in your work. Like, it's just not going to happen. And it also depends on what your goal is. Like, if your goal is like, okay, I've wrote a book, it's out there in the world, fine. Maybe you don't need to do that, right? If your goal is like, I want to use this book to launch into becoming a speaker and give keynotes and get a TED talk and do all of these things, go to South by Southwest. And, you know, if you really want this like extremely robust thing, I think that it is probably something that you would have to do on your own. It also depends on how big the publishing company is. Like if you're with Penguin Random House, you probably don't need an external PR.
Yeah. And okay, so how big is your publishing house that you're working with?
I think they're mid-sized. They are very niche. They're a boutique publishing. They're called Essie, and they specifically do psychology self-help books. They also do clinician books, like clinician resources. They are very, very well known in the psychology world here in the United States and Canada. They do a lot of CE credentialing for therapists. So like their primary market is clinicians. And they do, they have an annual conference. They have a lot of resources for clinicians, and they started off with doing clinician support books. So like if I'm a clinician, I want a book on CBT, like PESI is probably that for the most part. And they do a lot of workbooks. And a couple of years ago, maybe 10, maybe 8, don't quote me on this, maybe 20, I don't know. But a couple of years ago, they delved into direct-to-consumer self-help. So I'm under that arm.
Gotcha. Wow. It sounds so divine that you ended up with this publishing house who specializes in exactly what you do. They found you. I mean, it could not have worked out better. And it seems like they've been great to work with.
They are. They are so lovely. They, because maybe because they're all clinicians, I don't know, but like they are really amazing. They understood the whole stress and the anxiety and the imposter syndrome. Like they just got it, you know? And I never felt like, even with their feedback, you know, I never felt like they, that we were not on the same page, you know?
So your book is about toxic productivity. Can you tell us a little bit about your story with toxic productivity?
Yeah, you know, my God, I never really considered this as like an issue outside of me until I started noticing it probably around a couple of years ago when I was feeling very burnt out. And then I realized that in order to feel good, I always have to be doing something. And I was just like, even rest became this like thing that had to look a certain way, you know, like if I'm resting, I should be reading. Like it just became this like weird mess where I couldn't really, I felt like I couldn't separate myself from what I was doing. And it wasn't just like my professional doing, it became like, what am I doing in New York City? Like, am I going to all the shows? Like, am I checking out all the restaurants? Like, is this like, is my long weekend? Like, are we doing, like, it just became this thing where everything had to be optimized to its like most efficient and highest point, right? So I was living in this culture internally that I had created for myself to be like hyper optimized. And over time that really started burning me out. And I didn't really understand what was going on or why or whatever. And then I started doing a lot of research on this because I just wanted an answer to what was going on with me. And I came across a couple of like research articles that started talking about like this kind of stuff. So the concept of toxic productivity as a term is very new. Maybe it's like in the last 10 years where people started studying it. And maybe in the last 5 years, it's become a thing on the internet, right? And even now, it's not that used as burnout is, right? But burnout is a after effect of toxic productivity. So toxic productivity is the this notion that my productivity is what defines me as a person in my value, like my inherent self-worth, not my self-esteem, right? Your self-esteem is connected to your external achievements. Your self-worth is how valued you feel internally, inherently, as a human, as a friend, as a partner, right? As a student. And toxic productivity is when we develop a very unhealthy relationship with productivity because we are looking for it to fill the void of how good we feel about ourselves. And the book is about understanding all of these things first, right? Because I don't think, even myself included, like we don't understand these things very well. So the first part is really laying the landscape on productivity, healthy productivity, toxic productivity, self-esteem, self-worth, burnout, all that stuff. And then the rest of the book is about the mechanisms that keep us stuck in toxic productivity. So perfectionism, social comparison, shame, guilt, all of those concepts, you know, that you see on Instagram all the time, like these are mechanisms, these are coping skills that we develop in order to achieve more productivity so that we can continue to feel better about ourselves. So we're essentially like on this hamster wheel, you know, and then with every concept, there is like very tangible skills that you can use literally in that moment and then onwards to start to decouple this. The one thing I really want to highlight is productivity on its own is not a bad thing. And when people hear the term toxic productivity, they kind of think perhaps I'm like anti-productivity. And there is a lot of literature on that that exists. And there's a great book on that. It's called How to Do Nothing. But that's not what this is. So my perspective, my book is about how to develop a healthy relationship with productivity, not necessarily create an absence of productivity, which we need, but I'm not the expert in that.
When was the moment you realized that the productivity was beginning to be toxic?
Probably 2018. Yeah, probably the summer of 2018. Yeah, probably around there. Because 2019 was a year before the pandemic and I was already in it, but it was probably the summer before. And I had been in New York for a year and a half at that point. I was working at this very lean startup. We were doing a lot of like work. There's a lot of stuff happening. And at the same time, I was also trying to do all these other things, you know, and I just like started feeling bad about myself. And not to sound, you know, in any way, like that was not a very familiar feeling to me. And I was in my early 30s at that time. And for the most part in my life, I have been able to feel good about myself. I didn't really struggle with that earlier. But when it happened in my early 30s, like I didn't have any skills for it. I didn't know how to manage it. I was confused by it in the beginning. I immediately was like, oh my gosh, like, am I depressed? Like, what is happening? Like, and so that's kind of what prompted some of this like lifestyle change, like thinking about like optimization, perfectionism, like the guilt that I feel when I'm not rest, like not doing or that kind of stuff. So I would say probably 2018.
And so after you kind of realized what was going on, what were some of the tools that you adopted to help yourself through that?
You know, it's a little embarrassing, but I didn't actually realize and conceptualize in its whole entirety until the pandemic, until the quarantine. So there was a whole year and a half that I was still operating in this like autopilot, right? That I'm recognizing something that feels off, but I wasn't going deep enough. I was reading the research on it, but I wasn't going deep enough into my own life. The distance between awareness and healing is integration. How are you going to integrate that awareness into your day? So I wasn't doing the integrating. I was intellectualizing. I was like, oh, I've read this article and I read this, you know, book. And, right? Like,
well, but sounds familiar. Wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the easiest thing to do. Like I hide behind intellectualism all the time. It's like a thing that I do. I'm aware of it. My therapist knows, like we're working on it. But it was the pause of the quarantine that really where I was like, let me start thinking about this stuff, you know, like, let me, because I didn't need to go out anymore. So immediately it opened up so much time for me. And I have a lot of FOMO, right? And because I was working from home, everything was shut down. I was on my own. It became this like bubble of like, honestly, like the integration. And so the first 3 to 4 months of the quarantine were very pivotal for me in my personal journey.
So what does integration look like for you?
I think, you know, it's recognizing the habits that are almost like on autopilot that we're just not aware of, that we, oh, this is just who I am. This is how I am. This is how I operate, right? Like, oh, this is just my personality. Anything that has that label, like that's what you have to like look at. Because when we label ourselves as like, I was like, oh, I'm just like a fun loving person. Like, I just like going out all the time. I'm spontaneous, right? What does that label really mean? Like, let's look under the hood. And once you do that, then you're like, wait, this is why it's happening. Like this, I'm spontaneous because I just want more of all the experiences. But what am I sacrificing for that? My sleep, my eating habits, my money, right? Like, and then you start adding the changes that you have learned in your awareness journey or the whatever you read into the day-to-day. So the next time I want to make an impulsive decision about going to 3 parties on a Sunday because they all look cool, right? Like, I'm going to take a step back and I'm going to be like, wait, like, which one can I let go of? Like, do I really need to go to the party on a Sunday? Like, that's me integrating that awareness so that I'm not like operating on no sleep on Monday, right?
Are you an Enneagram 7? Did we talk about this?
I think I am.
I couldn't remember. I'm like a,
gosh,
I thought you may have said 5 at one point, but then later you said, actually, I think I might be a 7.
No, I think I'm a type 7. Yeah. I just quickly pulled it. I mean, I looked in my inbox. Yes. It says, explore the ways that you can share your adventurous spirit with others.
I love that. It's so appropriate, though, that you found also your the content that you want to write about and share with other people. It's like the lessons that you've had to learn within your own life, it sounds.
Yes. And I'm still learning.
Yeah.
Like it, when you read a book, if you read it, like you'll hear me talking about my own stories all the time up until like finishing the book.
Mm.
Right. Because remember in the beginning, I said I didn't really pause anything else.
Yeah.
It's because I just wanted to continue being productive.
Yeah.
While I read this book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what piece of advice would you give to someone else who perhaps wants to write a book or they want to take the plunge to start creating content more consistently or build their personal brand at all? Like, what would you say to that person?
I think for those 3 things, it's like 3 different things. Like if you want to write a book, and this is what I'll say to myself too, because when I do this again, like all of these learnings are going with me because it was incredible, but it was challenging. Like it was so challenging. I can't even tell you. So I think if you want to write a book, first, you have to really love the thing you're writing about because it's going to be in your life for like at least a year, if not more, right? And you're going to be in it and you're going to be looking at it and you're going to be finding newer ways to explain it or talk about it. Or if you're writing fiction, like, and you don't care about cheesemongers, like don't write a book about cheesemongers. Like, you know what I mean? Like you have to love what you want to write about. You don't necessarily have to know a lot about it. You can do that as you're doing your research. But I would say love what you want to write about. And then I think there's 2 ways people can get published, right? You write the whole book and then you seek publishers, or you seek a publisher who is open to pitches and then you work with them to write a book. So I think like find your what works best for you and gather as much insight as you can. If you know someone who has published a book, if you know someone who's a writer, you know, it doesn't matter. Like just reach out to them, buy them a coffee, ask them questions. I think that was very helpful for me. That's what I would say for somebody who's writing a book. And if you are writing a book, I would say definitely create a schedule for writing and treat it like a job. I think it took me a week to get it to that mindset.
Yeah.
And don't force yourself to write the way other people write. Like I really wanted to be an early morning riser. Like I wanted to be like somebody who wakes up at 5 and writes your book as the sun is coming up. But my creative streak always happens in the afternoon.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I'm so jealous of you. because I'm the opposite. Why? I'm like, I will get up really early and write in the morning. It's like the first thing that I do. But in the afternoon, forget it. I am zapped. I have the hardest time. I love that piece of advice, though, because typically people are looking for that one formula. Like, I want to do it this way. But I think it's so important to find what works for you. And the time of day makes a big difference, I think, for sure.
Yes. Everybody has their own body clock. And you don't have to go to the cabin in the woods to write either. Like, I really wanted to be that person, too. And then I realized, or a cafe or a hotel lobby bar here in the city, I just wanted to sit there and write. Or I went to, like, Paris to write. Like, no. Write where you write. Like, my best work happened in this room.
Yep.
Like, in my house. You know, my best writing happened in this house and not in a cafe in Paris. So just don't romanticize the process. Just write where you write, write when you write, and make sure that you have that accountability of, like, I'm going to write for 2 days this week, or I'm going to write for 4 mornings this week. I think for content creation and brand, I mean, brand, I feel like I learned a lot from PBA about branding. Like, it helped me really understand the foundations of what this even means, because I didn't know anything, like zero things I knew before I just created my Instagram account. I think for content creation and continuing to stay inspired for that is when you start to feel the inkling of being burnt out, like, take a step back. Mm. Don't wait for it to become this problem that you have to solve for, or then you just, like, hate it and you hate your life because now you have to do this, but you're not in the mood for it, right? So, like, if you start feeling burnt out, like, take a step back and then reevaluate your system. I think that's why a system is so important, right? I was doing that batch content creation on Mondays for, like, 6 hours, and I just didn't like that. Like, ew, right? Like, I'm saying it right now, and I didn't like it. It works for some people. So I had to take a step back and be like, I need to change my system. I need to, like, spread it across. I think planning content for 2 weeks in advance doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
Because I will read an article and I'll get inspired and I just want to, like, post it right away. Right. So I realized that 3 to 4 days out works for me. And, you know, I create the content 3 times a week. Like, and so you can adjust your system. But if you start feeling burnt out, like, you must hear that message. Like, you must. Your wellness as a brand, like a personal brand, as an entrepreneur, as a small business, like, your health is a line item on your budget. Like, you must take time out for it. You must accommodate for it. You must make sure that you care for yourself. Because then if you get sick or if you get burnt out, then that's it. Like, you know, that it's just you and your business, right? So I think that's what I would say for content creators.
Mm.
And the second very quick thing I'll say is, it's really hard not to compare yourself to others.
Yeah.
And the line between comparison and feeling inspired by somebody is very fine. And I think the reason a lot of us struggle is we don't want to accept that we are comparing ourselves to our peers and maybe feeling bad about it. Maybe, you know, feeling like wondering why they're getting the opportunities or the views or the whatever that you are not getting. I think all of those things are really normal. But if you ignore it and repress it, it finds a way to become poisonous. It will not go away if you ignore it. And that's a really big part of being a content creator, is just learning to be honest with yourself and accepting that you're not feeling good about X thing. Right. And then acting to protect yourself until you can feel better. So if you have to mute somebody, mute them for a little bit until you can gather your own thoughts, because that helps you process this feeling of jealousy or envy that is normal human emotions. It helps you process it in a healthy way, so it doesn't become destructive to you or towards that other person, because it's really easy to get, like, caught up in that. And I think, not only is that something I also have experienced, but it's also, I've heard it from other creators as well, like my own friends, right? Like, you can get really down on yourself, and that can be really destructive to your own work. Like, it can make you less creative. So I think, like, just accept the feelings that are coming with content creation and do what you need to do in that time to just kind of create some kind of self-care pocket. And then you can kind of, you know, come back to your regular after you feel better.
Yeah, I don't know if this helps you, but, you know, when I'm in a creation phase, I typically don't look at what anyone else is doing. Like, I will try very hard not to scroll TikTok or Instagram and just get into that mode of creation. And I think there's a difference between being a creator and being a consumer. And sometimes we're both and we wear both hats. But if you're on a roll and you have momentum, do everything you can to protect that momentum and to keep staying in your own lane, because it does help. And, you know, there's not to say that there aren't other creators who inspire me and who give me ideas for my own posts. I think there's a time and place for that. But I don't know. I think the best times where I felt inspired have really come from my own personal experiences or my own like intuition.
Yeah, I think the best content is also the content that is coming right out of your own experiences. That's something I've noticed. Those posts have done really well. Sometimes it doesn't even have a caption because I haven't had the time. It just like occurred to me something is happening in my life and I'll like share about it. And those posts do so well because it's real.
Yeah, it's real. So that leads me to the last question I have for you, which is, what does having an authentic personal brand mean to you?
Oh my gosh. I think for me, there's like two elements to it, right? One is what you talk about, and two, and the second is how you present. So this is, I mean, I'm in the mental health wellness world, so I'll just talk about that. I think that being authentic in your personal brand should always be aligned with the values you actually believe in. Because if you're spending time creating content and putting out the message that, hey, like X thing and Y thing and whatever, I think it's really important that it's aligned with you. So for example, I operate in a very like body neutral environment, right? Even with eating disorders, all of that stuff. If I were to do a brand partnership with a get fast diet tea, like that would not be authentic to my brand because my content, my work, and my personal values are body neutral, right? So I think that's what I mean is how you present yourself. Like it should be aligned with what you're saying because then people get confused and then they don't trust you, right? So, and then the first part was like about like how you're doing it, which is for me, like, I think you just have to show up the way that you are. Of course, we're all like a little, you know, polished, but you should not be so far away from your true self.
Yes.
So if you look at some of my captions, like I will share my own personal struggles with stuff, right? In my book, like I very openly talk about my own struggles with toxic productivity and shame. Right. And being an overachiever and coming from this like immigrant family where like that is the structure. Right. And so I think if you come from a place of perfection, it does not seem authentic. So for me, like the brand is like someone who is just aligned with your values. You don't have to share everything to be authentic, by the way. Like, you know, you don't put all your business out there. I barely talk about my partner on Instagram. Like he maybe shows up once a year. And so you don't have to share everything, but I think the things that you do share should be honest to who you are because people will eventually find out.
Yeah.
And we see this all the time, right? People will find out. And I do believe that when people are inauthentic, like our like instinct can feel it.
Energy.
Because there is, I mean, there is like an evolutionary benefit to identifying inauthenticity, right? Like, because immediately there's no trust there and there's no emotional safety anymore, right? And then you will tarnish your brand if you don't stay true. So I think that's what an authentic brand is. It also should have space for change. Human beings change, they evolve. And I think your brand should reflect that, right? And as you do it, it's important to kind of share the transitions that you are going through yourself, right? So let's say that I'm going to change my brand from mental wellness to physical wellness. Let's say I become like a, I don't know, personal trainer, right? Like I can't just do it. Like I want to bring those people along with the journey, like tell them why this is happening, like why I want to change this, like why I'm focusing on physical health now, blah, 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 whatever, right? And then take people along with you as you're changing, but don't be resistant to change because I think everybody changes.
Yeah, I think it's a sign of growth and it's a positive thing to see someone change and form, you know, new behavior. I also, as you're speaking, what comes to mind is this tremendous amount of care that you have for the people that you are creating content for, like the people that you're really serving. It's like truly considering them and putting care and love into the words that you write and how you show up online. And I think if we're coming from a place of love versus ambition, what we find on the other side is so beautiful and fulfilling for both of us, for both parties involved, for us and the people who see us.
Yeah, no, thank you for saying that. I think specifically, again, I can only speak from like my industry. For me, being a wellness practitioner in the social media space, like I take that very seriously. Not just because of like regulations and the regulatory body, but literally like the responsibility I have towards people who are reading my content from a place of like emotional growth and pain. A lot of people are going through a lot of stuff. The world is a horrible place right now in many ways. In many ways, it's beautiful and incredible, but people are struggling and they are turning to the internet right now to get mental health content and information. And it, like, I can't just say whatever I want because I want to make money or I want the post to go viral. Like, I can't do that because there are people on the other side who are seeking this information for their own personal lives. So everything must be backed by science. Everything I say absolutely has its roots in science because you can't just say stuff. Like, I see it a lot. I see it a lot. There are a lot of wellness practitioners who are not regulated and they say a lot of stuff that frankly is just not true. And it's scary and it's dangerous. And mental health is a very sensitive thing. And I think that we all have a responsibility to show up with a lot of care when we're saying things like, how do you set boundaries with your partner? Right. Or how do you care for yourself? I think that's really important.
Yeah. On both sides of the spectrum, you know, as a creator, using discernment for what we choose to put out into the world. And as a consumer, you know, what do we choose to consume and who are we choosing to follow and what are we choosing to read? And we have that choice to decide for ourselves. So,
yeah.
Thank you, Isra, for coming on. So valuable. Everything that you've shared with us. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.